thanks, Valeria, and thanks to Asaf and Leo for having me, and definitely learning a lot about improvisation, not only in terms of theories, but also in terms of practice, which is always good. So I'm going to talk about coordination and about the mechanisms that allow people to coordinate with each other, performing very simple actions like, passing objects, for instance. So at first glance, in a way, this is not very exciting compared to, let's say, free jazz or, jazz in general and contact improvisation or other improvisation in dance. And it seems to us that we can perform these actions pretty much effortlessly, right? I mean, passing an object to someone else, it's not a big deal. We don't think much about it. But once you start sort of looking at these actions more carefully and really trying to find out what's going on inside of people's mind as they're doing this, it turns out that this is actually very complex and there is a lot going on. So I want to give you a kind of overview of different coordination mechanisms that we've studied over the past years. And then at the end, I'll try and make a link to improvisation and discuss how these links, how these mechanisms could actually be there in improvisation and what might be different. So just to get us started, I want to show you this picture of Abigail and Brittany Hensel. They're conjoined twins. And the problem they face, in a way, is that they're sharing a body. Now, how are they moving this body? In principle, there could be different solutions, right? So you could imagine that each of them had full control over the body. So one of them could fall asleep and the other could go for a walk. But actually, that's not how things are organized in that case. So each of them is controlling the arm and the leg on their side of the body. So you can imagine what that means for walking, right? It means that every single step needs to be coordinated. And they've become very good at this. So this is an older picture. They're now in their early 20s. They've learned not only how to ride a bike, but also how to drive a car. They play basketball. They swim. They've mastered this act of coordination, but whatever they do requires this really fine-grained coordination. Now, in a way, that seems like a very peculiar case, but in a way, it's not, because whenever we engage in some kind of joint action with other people, we also have this problem of, having to get the timing right and having to, in a sense, act as a single unit. And there is a question as to the similarity between coordination within a person and coordination across people. So to what extent is coordination within a person also a model that we can use to understand coordination across people? And I should also say before I go on that, of course, it's interesting to think about the experience of being in that particular situation, just as it is interesting to reflect on the experiences we have when we act together. But my work is actually targeting mechanisms that we would normally call subpersonal, so things you're not aware of. And again, there's a lot of discussion that we need to have about how this links up with experience, and I'll try to say a little bit about this at the end. But as a default, just so to create a sort of mindset for us, the mechanisms are subpersonal, so not something you're aware of, not something you're doing deliberately. And we will see that sometimes there can be discrepancies, so where people report one thing and do another thing. And to me, these discrepancies are actually quite interesting. Okay, so here's an overview of what's to come. I'll talk about a few coordination mechanisms. The first one is about making predictions about other people. The second one is about making yourself predictable. Turns out that this is also important. Then I'll talk a little bit about how different role distributions emerge when roles are not assigned. And then in the end, I'll say a few things about improvisation. Okay, so I want to jump right to the first study. And this is a study where we were interested in the similarities and differences between planning to perform a coordinated movement within your own body, so using your two hands, and acting together with another person in a coordinated way. And the action we chose is a pretty simple one. It's clinking glasses together. That's something you can do by yourself, and it's something you can do with other people. So I don't know how well you can see this here, but basically there were two glasses, and there was a sort of paper wrap around them so that they didn't actually make any noise when they were touching. So we have a bimanual condition where people are planning to do this, and then we are interested in measuring EEG in what's going on in their brain during this planning phase. So we're not really looking at what happens once they've started moving. We're actually interested in how people prepare for this. So we have the bimanual case, then we have the joint case where each of two people is grasping one glass and they're clinking them together, and we have a control condition where they're doing this with one hand on their own. Now, how should we think about the joint case? If you look at it from a motor perspective, from the perspective of movement, then clearly what you're doing in the joint condition is more similar to what you're doing in the unimanual action condition. So you're taking one glass and you're moving it. But from a planning perspective, if you're taking into account the two parts, and if you're planning something about the relation between these two parts, the joint condition is more like the bimanual one. So even though the movements are actually very different that people perform, it could be that we see things in the joint condition that are similar to the bimanual one. Okay. Now, we're looking at a specific marker of motor activation. We don't just want to, you know, have these two conditions and then see what kind of differences we get. We actually have a more specific prediction here. And the prediction is based on the literature that has studied single individuals, which is generally, you know, the case in cognitive science. People normally study single people. So what we know already is that there is one particular component, it's called the CNV, that is higher, suggesting more motor activation in the bimanual case than in the unimanual case. So we already know this. And therefore we can ask, if we look specifically at this component, is it going to be like the bimanual case or is it going to be like the unimanual case? And here you see the results for this. So there's quite a long build-up. What you see plotted here is the activation from the time point where people get a cue telling them what to prepare for to the time point where they get a go signal telling them now act, okay? So we can see what's going on in their mind while they're not acting, which is good because then... Oh, it's all right. Oh, yeah. Oh, maybe. Thank you. All right. So there is this buildup of motor activation in all cases, but there is also a difference. Now, the difference is between the unimanual case, where people are acting on their own, that's the thin line here, and the other two conditions, the joint and the bimanual one. But the joint and the bimanual, as you can see, they're completely identical here. So even though people are performing quite a different movement in terms of the planning, it's similar, and importantly, the joint is like the bimanual. And then you see a peak when people are actually starting to act. So the CNV, I'm telling you this because of the next study I'll show you, the CNV actually peaks as people are starting to act. All right. So that's the first indication that when people are doing something together, there is a lot happening before they start moving. And indeed, at least in certain cases, the bimanual coordination case is a good model for understanding what's going on in the joint action case. Now, that was a very symmetric joint action where the two people were doing the same thing. What happens if we take a different case where things are a little bit more asymmetric? So we had a study where people were passing an object to each other, giving or receiving the object. And here you see the setup. So we actually have a projector that projects cues on top of the object telling people what to prepare for. And then they can, after a while, execute the action. And it's either going to be an individual action. They just lift the candle and put it back on the table. Or it's they're in the position where they're giving the object to the other person or they're in the position where they're receiving the object from the other person. All right. Now, one thing that's not very surprising is that if you're the person giving the object to the other, you start your movements faster than if you're the person receiving the object. We all have that experience, right? So, good. All right. But that means, given that the CNV peaks the moment you're starting to act, we expect the peak to occur much earlier in the person giving the object than in the person receiving the object, right? So in this graph that I showed you before, you see this peak that happens just when people are starting to move. So if people are moving much earlier in the giving condition, this is the time that passes until people start the movement. If they're starting much earlier in the giving condition than in the receiving condition, the peak should be very different. It should be apart by almost 400 milliseconds, which, you know, in this field is like huge because we sometimes talk about 10 millisecond differences. All right. Now, here's an interesting prediction. This difference in the two peaks would only occur if each of them is only planning their own action, right? But what if the person receiving the object is actually making predictions about the timing of the person giving the object to them? In that case, we might see a peak when they're not acting, but when they're expecting the other person to act, okay? So the peak should be earlier. And this is what we see. So you see this this build-up in the CNV, same component as what I showed you before. It peaks when people are starting to act. So the green line is for the condition where people are lifting the candle on their own. It also peaks when they're starting to act when they're giving the object. That's the purple line. And the interesting data point is the blue one because this is the received condition. So at this moment in time, the person receiving the object is completely still. They're not moving at all. They're moving 400 milliseconds later, and in fact, there is a second peak that you can't see here when they are starting to act. So this is interesting because it suggests that somehow they're running a sort of simulation of the timing of the other person. It's really as if they were the giver, in a sense. They're using their own motor system to be in the other person's position. They both get a cue. They both know what's going to happen. And they do this over and over. So I can also show you what happens over the course of the experiment. So, you know, with experiments like this, you need a lot of repetitions just for the data quality. So we can see what happens as people have done this like 100 times. What you see is that they get more synchronous over time. So what's plotted here is difference in the two onsets of the movements. So they become more coordinated over time. Less time passes between the onset of the giving and the receiving action. And those pairs where this is very pronounced, so those pairs where people become smoother over time, are also those pairs where the receiver has this very pronounced peak at the time of the giver's action. So this is just a correlation, and you have to be careful about, you know, making causal inferences. But it's interesting to see that it seems to have a relation to the quality of the interaction. So the smoother the more you're predicting your partner, the smoother the interaction. And there's also this asymmetry between the giver and the receiver here, right? Because in a sense, you could say the receiver is doing all the work. So perhaps we can make a link here also to this discussion about leading and following. So, you know, I mentioned before we can talk about experience or we can talk about these subpersonal mechanisms. And perhaps there's something interesting there because these people might not have the experience of being a leader or a follower. They might not conceive of the task in this way. But still, in terms of brain activations, you could say there is one person who's doing perhaps more of a follower's work than the other. Okay. Now, when we act together, it's one thing to sort of make predictions about the immediate actions of your partner, but often we're in a domain where there's some outcomes that we create together. So for instance, in music, you don't really care all that much, perhaps, about how your partner is producing a tone with their instrument or which finger they're using. You care about the music you're producing together. So this means we have to understand how people plan their actions with respect to the common effects that they produce. And also, if there are errors in the performance, we can then ask, how do people link these errors back to the contributions, right? So in a sense, you're always in this state of ambiguity when you're acting together. So if there's some kind of violation or error, often you can't be really sure, was it me, was it the other person? And sometimes the consequences for the group are bigger or smaller. So we thought it would be interesting to look at this process of error monitoring in a joint action situation. And for this, we looked at very skilled pianists playing specifically composed melodies together. And in a sense, maybe I shouldn't be talking about errors here, but violations, because what we did is we actually inserted violations. So these were very good pianists, and it's hard to get them to make a sufficient amount of errors. So you kind of have to, you know, if you want experimental control, you have to trick them in a way. And our trick was to insert violations. So, you know, we had the score, we knew what they were going to play. And then at specific moments, because this is a MIDI keyboard, you can just play a different sound to them. So even though they press the right key, you're giving them the wrong tone. It's kind of nasty, but we tell them, so there's no deception involved. They know this is going to happen throughout the experiment. And why are we doing this? We're doing this because we want to see how their brain reacts when we are inserting a violation that concerns their own part compared to a violation that is in the other's part. So this is one factor that we manipulate. So the error occurs in your own part or in the other's part. And the other thing that we manipulate is how severe it is in terms of the joint outcome you're trying to produce. Now, the way we operationalized that was in terms of harmony. So in one case, the tone that we inserted, so the error or the violation, actually didn't change the harmony. So even though it's a different tone, the harmony is preserved. So it's more in line with what you would expect. In the other case, we changed the tone, so the harmony is a different one. And importantly, it was composed in a way where even when there was a change in the harmony, it was musically completely expected. So it's not that this sounds, you know, ugly or people are disturbed by how it sounds. On the contrary, actually, this was musically more expected than what normally would have been produced in terms of the joint harmony. All right. And then there are two findings here. The first is the brains of these pianists seem to register any kind of violation. So what you see plotted here is a fairly early component that reflects detection of errors. And you can see that it has the same magnitude in all conditions. So you have here the response when the error is, the violation is in your own part, that self, or when it is in the other's part. And then H plus means the harmony, H plus and H minus means the harmony is affected or not. And here you can see that it's always the same. So, you know, the error has been registered. All right. So that means they seem to have a good expectation about what should have been the case. The more interesting aspect is if you look a little bit later what happens. So there is a component that also is very commonly found in these studies where people look at error processing. And this is a positivity that occurs around 400 to 500 milliseconds after the error. And now we see a scaling. So this is kind of about your evaluation of what happened. This is sort of your, you know, you're thinking, ooh, there was an error, something like that. And you can see that now it makes a difference what kind of violation it was. So if it was in your own part, there is a stronger reaction than if it was in the other's part. And you can see that the joint effect is also being taken into account, because if the harmony is violated, then you have the largest response. And if the harmony is not violated, you have a smaller response. And in fact, if the error is in your partner's part and the harmony is preserved, you don't care at all. So this suggests that people do make a difference between their own and their other errors, even though in some ways the monitoring initially is the same. And they're also thinking about the joint consequences. Okay. So this suggests that people care about joint products, and perhaps when they're planning actions, to some extent, they're really planning them in combination. Now, here's a study where we try to get at this more specifically. And the prediction is this. If you have this tendency to form a truly joint plan, if you sort of take the group as a unit, what should happen is that when you see a group of people or two people performing actions, you should have a tendency to imitate them. And we can make this prediction because there's a lot of literature that I'm sure was already mentioned also in Chris and Valeria's talks, where if you see a single person performing an action, you have a tendency to imitate this action, sometimes just covertly, sometimes overtly. So here the prediction is, if you form these plans on a group level or on a dyadic level, I should say, then seeing two people should make you especially prone to imitating what these people are doing. So just as a sort of analogy here, if you think of a clapping game, for instance, you could process this in terms of individual contributions, like you could figure out what each of the parts are, or you could think of this in terms of the relations of the actions that need to be performed. Okay, now the study here is a really simple one. You see this, so you see two hands, and then the index fingers are tapping. The index fingers are tapping. And your task is to tap in synchrony with the fingers. And we speed this up so it becomes a more difficult task over time. That's all. Really simple. And then the only manipulation is whether you see hands that belong to one person, the left and the right hand, or whether you see two people, and the way it's done is you see two right hands in this case. We have different studies with left and right. Doesn't really matter, actually. Okay, so you have two participants, each of them producing one tap. They're tapping in alternation. They're trying to be in time with the hands, and they're also trying to synchronize with the hand on their side. So if you're the right, if you're the participant sitting on the right, you should synchronize with this hand, and if you're a participant on the left, you should synchronize with that hand. So a lot of people who study action perception and action performance would think, you know, whether you see one person here or two people, it really shouldn't make a difference. There are these actions, you're going to imitate these actions, so what? Yes? It's you're told that there is one person or two people, but we also give a visual cue, right? Because here's it's a left and a right hand, and here you see two people. But in fact, I can anticipate, you know, we have experiments where we show a left and the right hand of two different people, and it also works. So it's just important that people are certain whether they see one person or two people. Yeah. Okay, so a lot of people would think this shouldn't make a difference, but if you think about it in terms of this group level planning, it could make a difference. And in fact, it does. So this is the performance of the person sitting on the left and the person sitting on the right as the movement tempo increases. And the measure here is about how faithfully they imitate the actions. I can say more about this later. It's just, you know, how often when the right hand on the screen moved, was that particular person in sync with the right hand? And what you see is that there is a difference between the condition where they see hands of two people and the condition where they see hands belonging to one person. And the degree of imitation or the accuracy of imitation is higher when they see two people than when they see one person. And that's true for the person sitting on the left and the person sitting on the right. And I mention this only because for the person sitting on the left, you know, the stimulus is actually the same here. Now, if you ask people to do this alone, you can also have a single participant just doing this with two hands. Things flip, right? So it's not the case that whenever you see two people, you're more likely to imitate what they're doing. It's really specific. So if you're by yourself, you have more imitation when you see a single person acting. So it flips. And I'm not showing you this here, but of course you can also play with things like the identity of the people you're observing. So in the Netherlands, we did some stuff with people from Morocco and Suriname who have quite a different status within the society. And then you see imitation actually only for certain groups and not for others. Again, suggesting it's really something about groups. And some people have made a link to the Wii mode that you mentioned earlier. I'm not sure what the Wii mode is, but it seems to fit with these findings. All right, so that was the part about predictions. Now here's a sort of unexpected part in the sense that I'm going to tell you about a coordination mechanism we didn't set out to find. The prediction stuff, we always thought it was going to happen, we should find this. This is something that came up in the data, and initially when we first had these data, actually for several years they were just lying around and we didn't do anything with them because, you know, the finding wasn't what we had predicted and we couldn't really make sense of it. And then eventually we ran a very different study and we got the same finding, and then we thought, oh, there must be something there. All right, so this is the task. It's super simple and not very exciting and very, you know, standard cognitive psychology. You see a stimulus, you have to make a response, and the only social thing about it is that your response should be in synchrony with the person sitting next to you. Okay? So you see that stimulus, you make a response, and we have, like, you know, two different stimuli, two different responses. Task is be as synchronous as possible. Now, you could solve this coordination problem by, again, making predictions about your partner, right, and trying to figure out sort of what their reaction times are like and how they change over time and so on. And this is initially what we kind of thought might be happening. But there's another thing you can do, and that is you can just try and be very stable yourself. So in this kind of situation, it's really hard to make predictions about your partner. That, you know, their performance fluctuates in a way, and you can never get it right. And in fact, you get into what people have called hyper-following, where, you know, if they were a little bit slower, then you slow down, but then they're faster and so on, and you never quite end up in synchrony. So the alternative is to just make yourself predictable. And if two people do this, chances are actually that they're going to be more coordinated. And then this is what we find. So people are faster when they do this together than when they do this alone. These are reaction times. And that's very stable, again, across many repetitions. And this is the standard deviation. So this is a measure of how stable people are in their performance. And you can see that they are, so a lower standard deviation means they're more stable. So they're more stable doing this together than doing this alone. And we can look at the link between speed and variability. And what we see there is that reaction time itself predicts asynchrony. If they're faster, they're actually more coordinated, but not if you control for variability. So it's really variability that's driving the coordination performance. The less variable they are, the more coordinated they are. And we don't see this in a condition where two people are doing the same task but without intending to coordinate. So it only happens when they're trying to be coordinated. It also works when they're acting in succession. So this is just a variation where one person needs to act before the other person. And if we look at what the person who acts first does, you see exactly the same thing as before, so the same kind of links. And it also works in very different tasks. So here's a new task that's a bit more interesting for the participants, a sort of space shuttle task. You need to move this space shuttle to a planet and arrive at the same time as another person. We wanted to do this with kids, actually, I should say. So this is why it has this kind of, and there's some asteroid belts in the way and so on. So it's a very different task where people are moving a mouse, computer mouse, to arrive at this planet at the same time. And we manipulate here whether people can see each other or not. And we predict that this mechanism of making yourself predictable should occur, especially when you cannot see each other, right? So if you have no other information about the person, this is when making yourself predictable should really be the thing to do. And that's what we find. So when the other person is hidden, when you can't see them, then you are faster and the standard deviation is lower than when the other person is visible. And I won't go into this, but we get the same links again between variability and asynchrony. And one thing that I found very interesting is that there is a recent paper where they did a somewhat similar task with macaque monkeys and also found this principle that in a joint condition compared to a solo condition, the pairs that they studied quite consistently showed less variability in the joint case, that's the black bars, than in the individual case. So this is really a mechanism that seems to be very basic. It's not something that you have to, you know, think about and decide to engage in. It's perhaps something that's just built into our system where if we have very little information about someone and we can't really predict what they're going to do, we just try and be predictable ourselves. And I think you can also see this in very different contexts. So I was in India a while ago, and I was completely fascinated by the traffic there. You know, the way people navigate in this really dense traffic, it's so skillful and sometimes actually quite fast. And I think a lot of different coordination mechanisms that people rely on, some also, of course, linked to cultural conventions. But I think there is, you know, many situations where you see this principle of making yourself predictable. So if a person goes over a roundabout, they just follow one trajectory, whatever happens, and they sort of indicate to other people, this is where I'm going. Okay. Now, how am I doing with time?
About 5 minutes.
Okay. I think I'll skip this and continue here. So I told you there are two mechanisms, right? One is predicting what other people are doing. One is making yourself predictable. Now, here's a situation where the two work together. So this is a study where people had to make a jump on one leg. Again, without being able to see each other, it's kind of, I understand it's a very unnatural situation, but we use this to try and isolate these mechanisms. And their task is to land at the same time. So we're telling them, from now on, you can go, and then it's up to them how they solve this problem. And it really is a problem because we're giving them different distances to cover. So one person needs to make a long jump, the other person needs to make a short jump. So it's not easy to arrive at the same time, and once you're up in the air, there's very little you can do, right? Okay, now I won't go into detail here. The only thing I want to tell you is that in this study we see the two mechanisms operating sort of together because the task of the two people is very different and each of them goes for a different mechanism. So one of them makes predictions about the other and the other is just trying to be predictable. So if you have the easier task, and that means you have a jump that's not so far, what you do is you take into account the jumping distance of your partner. So this person delays their movement onset as a function of how far it is that their partner needs to jump. If the partner has a really long jump, they wait longer before they start. And they do this in a really fine-grained way so that they land almost in synchrony. It's like maybe it's less of a difference than 100 milliseconds. However, if you're the person who has this difficult jump, you need to cover a long distance, you don't care about your partner. You just jump. That's all you do. And you try to be predictable again. So here you have a natural role distribution that emerges. Nobody told people to solve the task in this way. And if you're getting them to reverse the task, so if the person with the short jump is now performing the long jump, then they also switch their strategy. So it's not something about people's personality that one person, you know, is likely to make predictions about the other and the other is just trying to be predictable. It's really a function of the role in the task here. And just to make that point that people often naturally find a solution to task distribution, here's a study by Mike Richardson and others where two people had to move in such a way that their movement paths would actually normally cross. So you would collide if both just took the straight path. And what you see is that they actually call this leader and follower here. You see that one person is going the straight path and the other person is doing something elliptic and there is an offset in their onset. So they are in a different phase relationship. I think it's a 30-degree difference, if I remember. And this is something that emerges over time. So you can see this is what they do at the beginning, and then later during the experiment, and these are different pairs. And it's a very stable finding that people naturally fall into these different roles. Okay, now to wrap up, or not really wrap up, to confuse everyone, including myself, and raise a lot of questions, let's talk about improvisation, finally. So I have two slides, and the first one is sort of the conservative and optimistic one that's saying, well, yes, of course, you know, these coordination mechanisms I just talked to you about, they play a role in joint improvisation because we need to be coordinated. So in that sense, you know, it's almost trivial that they should play a role. And then the question for us is perhaps more to figure out in what way exactly and to what extent they need to be modulated. So for instance, when you think about predicting others' actions, well, if you don't know what the other person is going to do, how can you predict their actions? But that's only a matter of time scale, right? So it could be that on a more shorter time scale, these prediction mechanisms are still operating. It could also be that you're generating a lot of different predictions because that's not costly for your system. You can run parallel predictions and then eventually you narrow them down. So there could be a role for prediction. There could be a role for this monitoring of joint action outcomes that I showed you in the context of the piano playing. Then this mechanism where you take the group as a unit of planning, I think could be a very important one because whatever you do, you might sort of link it to some sort of joint outcome representation that you have. And I think some of the work that Leo has done about people sort of mutually predicting each other is in line with this idea and is spelling it out in a lot more detail. But here's the but. You know, I think there is a big difference between improvisation and solving coordination problems because improvisation is not about solving coordination problems, right? It's about having a sort of playful exploration, and you're almost deliberately engaging in something that is error-prone. It's not that you want to be as effective as possible necessarily, right? So here are some other ideas that are more speculative. The first is perhaps learning how to improvise together is also about learning to resist the operation of some of these coordination mechanisms. So, you know, it could be a bad idea to make yourself predictable because it takes all the fun out. Or you want to do it only to a certain extent or only at certain moments. It could be a bad idea to go for these role distributions because then you fall into these leader-follower patterns rather than, you know, making yourself open to different kinds of interactions. And I would tend to think from experience and watching people, you can be in these situations where there is no leader and no follower. So we're kind of in a paradoxical situation where on the one hand, of course, we want to rely on the coordination mechanisms that we have, but on the other hand, they might not serve us well, and a lot of this automatic subpersonal stuff might be getting in our way. And then that takes us further, of course, to think about the link between the common knowledge that we have. So as Steve mentioned in his talk, you know, this improvisation doesn't happen in a void. There is a lot of knowledge we rely on, in addition to trying to achieve this online coordination. And as I mentioned earlier, there's something about experience and the link between these online coordination mechanisms and experience that I think we don't really understand yet. And one thing that I was sort of thinking as I listened to some of the talks is that the way we talk about experiences in the context of joint improvisation could also be seen as a cultural technique, as a kind of cultural tool that works on these subpersonal mechanisms. So I don't think the solution for us is to introspect and, you know, talk about our experiences and then hope that there is going to be a sort of one-to-one mapping between the subpersonal mechanisms and the experiences. I think the relationship is probably much more complex and quite different. For instance, something I forgot to mention is that when people are in this sort of we mode where they imitate more when they see two people rather than when they see one person, no one can tell you that this is happening. So if we ask participants, they tell us, these conditions were the same. The experiment makes no sense. You know, I was always acting in the same way. But that's not what's happening. So there's this discrepancy between experience and what we see. So the point is that experience could also serve as a cultural technique that operates on these mechanisms to help us improvise. So one idea would be that the way we conceive of improvisation actually helps us reduce, you know, this sort of planning ahead that comes from executive functioning. You know, perhaps sort of makes us more willing to just let these subpersonal mechanisms operate. For instance, you know, the kind of predictions that our brains generate without us sort of thinking whether that's now appropriate or not. And I just put this reference there because Eitan Wilf is someone who's, you know, sort of looked at what people think about improvisation and creativity. And I think it's important for us, and that was also mentioned before by Steve, to also have this sort of social anthropological perspective where we realize that in the end, I mean, there's also something very romantic about the notion of joint improvisation, and it shapes how we think about it. And I'll end on this note. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie. And okay, so you raised two hands. How much time do you can I give her for the
2 minutes? Until half past 11.
Okay. First, second, and third, and then
here. Yeah, thanks very much for the great talk. I'm very interested in those emerging roles. Mm-hmm. And I think my question is, we've done lately, we've been trying to move beyond the pairwise things mm-hmm. into larger groups. Mm-hmm. And so so the interest in some ways, like setting up the situations in two of them sort of is an incentive. The easiest or like the sort of perhaps best solution to the task is for these leader-followership relations to emerge. But even in the example that you gave from the Indian traffic, where there is a much larger group of people and you meet everyone only exactly once, perhaps. Huh. So what would be, I just want to know what, if you have some bold predictions about how these things would happen in larger groups of people who you probably meet only once or less than many times.
Yeah, so two things. I think one is that in larger groups where, you know, things are anonymous and you meet people only once and so on, I think you do tend to see a reduction to really simple mechanisms because you can't make predictions for everyone, right, and keep track of everyone. So that's why I think, you know, in the traffic, people are just trying to be predictable and not much more than that. And in fact, I guess in other cultures, it goes even lower, that people are just trying to move slowly and make small steps, not to bump into each other and things like that. But there are other cases where you still don't quite know exactly what other people are doing, but nevertheless, role distributions emerge. So I'm thinking Bob Goldstone has done some really nice work in a game where he gives people a number, and it could be groups between 7 people, 30 people. They manipulate the group size. So you give people a number, and then everyone, each individual, independently of the others, says a number, and you add these numbers, and together they should add up to the target. And you can give people feedback only in the sense of you're too high or too low, or you can give them more specific feedback. And then people do this a few times to finally, you know, reach the number. And what you see there is a really interesting distribution, because you have some people who are very stable. They hardly ever change the input that they give. So if they've said 12, they'll say 13 or 11 or whatever. And then you have people who fluctuate a lot. They go up and down. So they're sort of regulating the group outcome. And the groups where you see this distribution are doing much better than the groups that don't have this clear, you know, sort of distribution between the passive individuals and the ones who are making these changes. And it's a really interesting question why people are being passive. I mean, are they just lazy and they can't be bothered to engage in the task? Or are they being very strategic about it and they realize that, you know, often you need to hold back in these group situations in order to move forward? Because if everyone is, you know, sort of trying to be the one solving the problem, then it's not going to work. So I think it's really interesting to look at larger groups, yeah.
I was really, really grateful for your last slide, not only because of the cultural emphasis, which I welcome, but also because of the notion of resisting the automatic mm-hmm. mechanisms that would kick in easily in people. I think it points towards an agenda of learning to distinguish different kinds of situations or kinds of tasks and figuring out the different modes, cognitive modes or mechanisms these take. And I just want to give you a brief example. About the same time that you came out with your first papers, I began studying tango dancers and noticed that in tango followers, action prediction emphatically results in disaster usually, especially if subtle motor activations start to kick in. So there could be some probabilistic prediction perhaps, certainly not a definite prediction. And I speak as someone who danced with a predictor for years, and it was awful, really. I mean, she was a good dancer, but it wasn't enjoyable because it really destroys the feeling of unity in the couple, right?
Yeah.
So I started thinking about what other mechanisms are actually responsible or what mechanisms could take the role of prediction in that setting. And I think an interesting influence was Rolf Pfeiffer's work on offloading to structure, to bodily mm-hmm. structure. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, like the automatic walker and that kind of stuff. So anyway, I guess the basic point is that in many settings you have ongoing, previously constructed dynamic that's already in place, and because of that dynamic, because you don't start from scratch with the task, but you have prepared your body or whatever it is, this really facilitates the task, and you don't have to resort to these kinds of mechanisms.
Hmm. Just on your first point about the follower, because that's something I find really intriguing. I've done some tango dancing, and I've noticed this difference. Like on days where I don't think ahead, you know, things work much better than when I overthink what the next, you know, sort of things could be. And I guess the other question is really what kind of predictions are we talking about? Because, you know, this could be sort of more the level of decision making, and, you know, sort of really about, you know, figures or steps, or it could be about, you know, the particular micro-scale timing of the next step. And I'm not sure we're not making, I mean, I'm not sure that as a follower it doesn't make sense to make predictions about, let's say, the micro-timing or so. I guess you do that automatically. I guess the problem is only about making predictions on a sort of higher level in the hierarchy that are about, that are more sort of in the realm of decision-making. You know, is it going to be this figure or that figure, or step to the left or to the right or so? But making sort of fine-grained temporal predictions, I guess, wouldn't hurt. But something to think about and maybe figure out how to study.
Yeah, yeah, I really enjoyed your last slide, and it's sort of related to those comments. Because I feel like, at least being trained by dynamicists, that there's a personality type where if you're trying to understand something, you either like to draw straight lines in between things, or you like to draw a ton of circles and arrows pointing in all directions. And both of them have explanatory gaps in their own ways. But your last point about improvisation as intentionally engaging in something that's error-prone or trying to stop some of these subpersonal coordination processes. Because some of the presentations in these past few days have sort of talked about that as a good thing, as mm-hmm. something that's a marker of a healthier system. And if you have any comments about, you know, like what instances it's good or bad to have these two approaches, one of the two approaches.
So with two approaches, you mean?
Like engaging sort of in the personal coordination, right. Sub-personal coordination process.
Or trying to resist some of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that it's not something you sort of switch on and off, you know, sort of like the light. I think it's more that there are certain kinds of mechanisms that are perhaps always useful and others that are not. And I think, at least given what I know, I think we're not there to say, you know, in which situation you would predict which mechanisms to be successful. And I think this is, in a sense, something that we should work towards, right? So, you know, sort of if you think about what kind of experiments could we do, I would imagine we would want to do something where we specifically disrupt one kind of mechanism and see whether that actually helps or hinders improvisation. And then over time, hopefully, we would understand if, let's say, you know, prediction in general is harmful, for instance, for a follower, or if it's only certain kinds of predictions on a certain kind of time scale or with a certain kind of content that are harmful.
Yeah. Hi. Is it working? Yeah. Okay. Going back to the personality question, I was thinking the main measure for motor coordination was the reaction time and variability in reaction mm-hmm. time, right? Which is the main marker for ADHD. Because when we do a TOVA test, mm-hmm. this is the main outcome. The variability in reaction time says whether we go on and give that person a Ritalin or Adderall or whatever, and see if it... My first question is whether you think that ADHD patients will be less coordinated, less synchronized with others. And crazy, but maybe creative one, is that maybe you want to try give them like a... stimulates like Ritalin, Adderall, and see whether it enhances synchronized with that, because it also works on motor neurons and also on reward, which is really important for social.
No, I think it's a really interesting suggestion. I can really only speculate, but given what you said, yeah, you would expect it should have an effect on coordination. And you could also look at combinations of people. You can have two ADHD people or only one with a, you know, sort of more stable partner.
So
it could be interesting. And just thinking, we just had Richard Ramsey visiting us, actually on Wednesday, this is why he couldn't be here on Wednesday. And he talked about attractivity and variability. So to me, this was completely new and also a bit strange. I mean, I'm not really into individual differences, but his point was that he measured people's reaction times and how variable they were in the task, and he took photos of them, of their faces, and then he created morphs of all the people who were very stable and very predictable and all the people who were very fluctuating, and it turns out that in terms of attractiveness, the people who have less variability are preferred. So he was trying to make a sort of evolutionary argument, and I don't want to embrace this. I just want to mention it because it's an interesting sort of new direction. So it seems that, you know, how variable you are in your timing could be a very basic thing that has a lot of consequences for social interaction. Yeah.
Is it less variable or more attractive?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Because they have ADHD.
Yeah, it's good to know the directionality of it.
I mean, thank you, Natalie. I mean, it was a really beautiful talk, and there's so many questions I can't even imagine. Start. I'll just ask one then, which is about the CNV data about the giving, receiving, mm-hmm. and the question I already asked you. I'll follow up on what I asked you, clarification question. So, given that both, I mean, I'm wondering. So, thinking of Hubert Godard, like pre-movement or Arendt's work, the pre-acceleration, mm-hmm. which is kind of a similar idea. So the way we read another person's info, we know what they're going to do way before they're actually doing mm-hmm. it because mm-hmm. there's so many other cues that come out. I wonder if you have done the study, if you've thought about doing the same giving, receiving, but only the giver knows when the cue comes in and the receiver is only mm-hmm. reading off from them and to what extent then the CNV would be aligned or not, or at least it might be viable, because I think, you know, in the end, coming to experience in tango, and for me, and I mean, it's very much what, I mean, tango is interesting, and that goes back to Stephen's work, actually, and some of the discussion, because you have both the music, so the so-called, I don't know what to call it, because apparently I can't say the woman, because it's, you know, I don't mean the sex, the gender, and I don't like the word follower, but that person is both reading it off from the music. I mean, we know when the music is very regular, but they are also having, in order to be able to dance, to read actually the non necessarily regular movement. I'm wondering if you thought about that.
I like your suggestion very much because I think it predicts that there will be learning. So I'm actually very interested. I haven't presented these studies to you, but I'm very interested in learning now and how people learn to be coordinated, you know, for things that they cannot do right from the start. And I think if you take away the go signal so that the receiver cannot see it, you need to learn about the timing of the other. It won't be there from the beginning. So I think my prediction would be that you see the CNV eventually, but you need to have this history of interaction where you learn about the other's timing. And so, yeah, it would be nice to do that. Thank you. It's a great suggestion.
From my experience, the complexity comes also that we not only read or predict the actions of people, but we can read the expectations of the other person, and they can read what we expect or how we read their expectations, and it gets very complex, like the mirror. So you say, I choose A or B. You think I would choose
That's
A,
right.
Now you choose B. And so it's a very... In improvisation, I think then these two things, predictability and non-predictability, they kind of interlace.
Yeah, I would think that these expectations are often, I mean, the first thing is that they're kind of effortful, I would think, because you have to engage in this mentalizing about what does the other expect me to do and do they know that I have this expectation and so on. So if you're in a situation where there's a lot of time pressure, like in dancing or in football or many different examples you could think of music, I'm not sure people are able to do this sort of online. And maybe it's a good thing that they can't, especially in improvisation, because you're sort of... predictions about others' expectations or your assumptions about common knowledge are often wrong anyway. But it would be interesting, again, to sort of know when this is useful and when people are doing this and when they're not. And people have very different intuitions. So in philosophy, people writing about joint action, of course, are always talking about joint intentions. And there, this notion that you both know that you want to do this together is really, really central. But I think there are many joint actions we can get done, or, you know, children can get done, or other animals can get done without having this common knowledge necessarily.
Well, actually, it works with babies, and I think they don't
need
to rationalize how to read somebody's expectations. So
it's
not really, maybe not cortical.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. An excellent talk, very, very interesting stuff. And I'd like to just comment on the, and maybe ask you to comment more on the resisting coordination, because I think we have a bias here that everyone who's doing these studies of dyadic interaction or joint action or whatever, it's all about coordination. How do you get people to coordinate? What, you know, so there's not many studies where you actually try to either actively disrupt or ask people try to resist coordination. Oh. Because, well, we did with Netta, we did one experiment on resisting entrainment, just mm-hmm. on finger tapping. Mm-hmm. And musicians are worse at that than non-musicians. I mean, it's probably not a surprise. What was slightly surprising to us was that we were expecting that personality would play a big role, that how empathetic you are would actually influence this, but we didn't really find any effects there. But it's just one study, but I don't know if you have any other experimental ideas on how to study this resisting.
I could imagine that it's really about making a self-other distinction and therefore achieving more independence. So, you know, perhaps the default is really to fall into entrainment. And I mean, we also saw it yesterday where we had this piece, right, where there were two groups with two different rhythms and you were trying to keep your own rhythm. And I mean, there's actually, I think there's a practice, congado, that is like that, where, you know, that it's about group, it's a way of measuring group cohesion. So the group keeping their own rhythm wins because they seem to be the group with the larger cohesion. But so I think what you need to train then is this distinction between self and other and this detachment to some extent. And that requires a lot of skill. So I'm just thinking, some of you will know FACE by Aunt Teresa, the Cares Markers, right, this piece. And there, you know, they start out moving in synchrony, and then you have a phase transition where the phase relationship changes. And these things, I think, are extremely hard to do in music and in dance. And what you need to do is you need to decouple yourself from the other person. So perhaps the skill at least partly consists in, you know, sort of knowing when to have this kind of decoupling and when to fall back into the more standard mechanisms that we all have. Just speculating.